This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening on this, a sad day for fans of The Sopranos, a sad day for actors, for people in the entertainment industry. We'll have some thoughts today on how one actor captured a sense of America at the turn of the century and changed television forever. We say goodbye to actor James Gandolfini, who died yesterday. Also, the rarity of really great teachers. We'll have a conversation about that. We'll look at why there are financial jitters across the world today and this week. And is it just the luck of the draw, or is there a problem in the way we prepare teachers for the classroom? Also, does calling obesity a disease mean we're closer to a cure? We'll have a debate coming up. But we begin on Capitol Hill, where immigration reform has become a call for walling up, you might say, America's southern border.
At the end of the day, the only way we're going to pass an immigration reform law out of the House and Senate so the president can sign it is if it has real border security measures within it.
That's Senator Marco Rubio in an interview with ABC's This Week program. But what does that mean, real border security measures? Republican Senator Ted Cruz yesterday on the Senate floor believes he knows.
No one who cares about our humanity would want to maintain a system where the border isn't secure. This is a system that produces human tragedy.
Joining us now from Capitol Hill is Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Todd, welcome back.
Hi, John.
So it was always the case that this debate over immigration reform was going to pivot on the question of border security versus issues of immigration, forgiveness, amnesty, those kinds of questions. We knew that. Where does it stand right now?
Well, it certainly has. And what you're seeing now is that Gang of Eight proposal, that bipartisan proposal that was supposed to get a bill past the Senate, not enough. And so Gang of Eight members are now negotiating with Republicans over border security. And John, they're getting close to an agreement, apparently. Here's what's at stake. That Senate bill says that the pathway to citizenship for 11 million undocumented immigrants that we all know about that's in the bill, it doesn't kick in until the Secretary of Homeland Security can certify that a plan to secure the border has started to be implemented. It doesn't say it has to have any results, just started to be implemented. Republicans, like Ted Cruz and others, say that's nowhere near strong enough. We don't know that that plan will ever be implemented. We want to have the bill say that you have to prove that you're apprehending 90% of people who are trying to cross the border. Well, in a deal that appears to be emerging between the Gang of Eight senators, Republicans and Democrats, and some Republicans, not Ted Cruz, by the way, he'll never vote for this bill in any form, but between the Gang of Eight and some other Republicans, they're getting close to a deal that says, all right, we'll back off that 90% requirement, but we want a lot more money for border security and border agents and a guarantee, as you said in the intro, John, that we're going to build that fence on the southern border, and then we might be able to agree to this bill. And they appear to be getting close to an agreement there, and that's to the delight of some Republicans who wanted to be able to get to yes on this bill, but they needed stronger border security, which is why you heard Gang of Eight member Marco Rubio, who struck this deal in the first place, going around saying, we need more. It appears he's going to get it.
How close are we to the 90% threshold? The Obama administration has been touting its much more aggressive approach to the border along the Rio Grande and in Arizona, where things have really significantly improved. What are these metrics?
And the answer is nobody really knows, and there's a whole lot of faith and trust us involved in these metrics, and that's why a lot of Republicans don't like it. Nobody knows exactly how many people are being apprehended now because it's by nature a clandestine activity. You don't know how many people you don't catch. You can only guess. They're going to probably drop, though, the requirement that somebody proves that they're apprehending 90%. And here's what Republicans are getting in return, by the way, John, something that happened earlier this week. The Congressional Budget Office released a score of the Gang of Eight Senate bill and said, no, this bill isn't going to cost a lot of money. Well, it costs money, but it's not going to cost the deficit over 10 years. It's going to cut the deficit by $175 billion over 10 years, because when you normalize these 8 million of these 11 million people, you get a whole lot more tax revenue. $700 billion over 20 years. That seemed like a huge boost for the Gang of Eight, and it was. But you know who it was also a boost for? The Republicans, who want more money on border agents and border security and a fence. Why? They point to that CBO score and say, hey, you guys have the money. Give us some of it for the fence.
Exactly. So the supposed carrot of all that money is going to be funneled into investment in this sort of border security. And then, of course, once we get out of the Senate, looking at the House, they've laid down their own marker. Here's House Speaker John Boehner.
My goal is always to bring bills to the floor that have a strong Republican majority. Immigration reform, it's a very difficult issue. But I don't intend to bring an immigration bill to the floor that violates what I and what my members of my party, what our principles are. And so I continue to believe that you'll see strong bipartisan majorities for bills that we bring to the floor.
Now, he's talking about preconditions for even coming to the floor, something that matches Republican principles. Please elaborate. Are the House Republican principles different from the Gang of Eight Republican principles, or just even the Senate Republican principles?
So very different from the Gang of Eight. And if you're for immigration reform, here's where your enthusiasm for a deal over the Gang of Eight in the Senate becomes despair over what might happen in the House, because that Gang of Eight Senate bill is still teetering. House Republicans have called it dead on arrival in their chamber. What is Boehner saying there? Not just strong bipartisan majorities. He's kind of softening what he really means. What he really means is he's not going to put a bill on the floor that doesn't have 218 Republican votes. I want to be able to pass this bill with only Republicans. A speaker on a sensitive issue like immigration will be too weak if he relies on Nancy Pelosi to pass this bill. So the dream of getting 70 votes in the Senate, a strong showing, John, a bipartisan showing to get a big bill passed, to put public pressure on the conservatives of the House, it appears with this deal I was describing, maybe they'll get there, maybe they'll get that 70. At the end of the month, John Boehner is saying, it doesn't matter if you get that 70. I'll never put that bill on the floor. It does not have a majority of Republicans. So you guys are going to have to negotiate over whatever we pass. And then, John, we all have to sit around and see if there's any common ground between a bipartisan Senate proposal and a conservative proposal that John Boehner can get passed. And that is a very, very difficult question to answer. Well, I wouldn't be terribly optimistic, but it's possible.
I mean, flexibility there in the House, really the legacy of the old fiscal cliff wounds that Boehner suffered. He doesn't have a great track record on these kinds of votes, and so he wants a guarantee up front. Todd Zwillich, thanks so much.
You're sure, John.
On immigration reform, Todd Zwillich, takeaway Washington correspondent there on Capitol Hill. So how relevant is this Capitol Hill rhetoric to the realities of the communities on the U.S. southern border? Aaron Pena joins us now. He's a former Texas state representative whose district is located right along the U.S.-Mexico border. Aaron Pena, welcome back to the show.
Glad to be here, John.
What are you hearing when you listen to the Rubios, the Cruises, and the other lawmakers on Capitol Hill trying to come to a deal here?
The perspective from citizens on the border is we just need some sort of resolution to this longstanding open wound. I mean, there are real people who either, to use the example of some of the young children who've been brought to this country, who've been raised here, who may not even speak the Spanish language and yet have the possibility of being sent back to Mexico. There are people who've been living and working here. This is now their country. They want a resolution. There is some concern about the apprehension rate trigger. 90% is a threshold that's quite high. If I was to ask New Yorkers, for example, let's get a 90% apprehension rate on people who use drugs, I dare say that that is a near impossibility. And so this discussion of more agents, more agents does not concern us, although, the border has been hardened and it has changed the culture of the border. Most of these agents are from the community, and we feel comfortable with them. There are issues of security that are relevant to each of us, but the bottom line is we have to have a solution.
And from your perspective, and part of the interesting thing about talking to you, Aaron Pena, is as a former Texas state representative, you've been on both sides of this. You've been a Republican and a Democrat. Solving the chaos question for illegal immigrants is much harder, in your view, than dealing with the security questions, which are more of a tweak, as you see it?
Right. The immigration debate touches some deep cultural nerves, and we're talking about changes in demographics, as you can see across the Southwest. Texas, for example, is rapidly becoming a Hispanic-dominant state. That has repercussions for the politics of the state. Republicans who have have control of the state are fearful that if they lose Texas, the presidency will be lost because California, Florida, Illinois, New York are already in the Democratic stronghold. So this touches deeper issues of concern for many people involved in politics and for the public at large.
So, Aaron, let's move away from politics, and let me give you a devil's advocate question here. I mean, people do have a well-founded interest in not having immigration reform become an invitation for the border to open and for there to be a greater influx of people who would then put us in this same position of chaos, you know, 20 years from now. Is there a reasonable notion of border security that can go with immigration reform as you see it?
Well, you know, the problem that we had when we last dealt with this issue as a country under the Reagan administration was that they didn't really finish the job. There are problems that with continuing waves of undocumented people coming across the border. And we certainly feel that on the border. It you know, we go from being a Mexican-American community to more culturally a Mexican community. And although that distinction may be hard for people to appreciate, there are cultural differences between the two communities. And so there has to be some level of enforcement. I'm talking about, some sort of enforcement on the business community, and the business community may not like that, but we cannot have continuing waves of people that are unregulated. And of course, the issues of concern that people now have post 9/11 with regards to who's coming in and the dangers to our country.
So
most of those concerns, they're somewhat overblown. The reality is most of these people are coming over for
economic
a better
reason,
way of life.
Right. And the security issue really depends on businesses being cooperative. It can't just be the agents. Aaron Pena, thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
Speaking to us live from the KUT studios in Austin, Texas, former Texas State Representative Aaron Pena, whose district is located on the border. Coming up, we're remembering Emmy Award-winning actor and soprano star James Gandolfini, who died yesterday at the age of 51. If you're a fan, what are your favorite moments, quotes, scenes from Gandolfini's work? David First, morning host at New Jersey Public Radio, shared his favorite.
If New Jersey had a Mount Rushmore, he would be one of the faces up there, probably right next to Bruce. It's hard to pick a favorite moment from The Sopranos. So many great moments. The one that always comes into my mind, I know I'm not alone on this one, is the image from the very first show, the swimming pool, the ducks, and just the way that episode finished using that Nick Lowe song, The Beast in Me. I just remember that moment so vividly, and the feeling that I had just witnessed one of the great TV beginnings.
Tell us a story, 8778 My Take, on the life and legacy of Gandolfini.
You are unbelievably cute.
Thank you. Thanks.
Let me see those eyes.
The tough, gentle smile and warm voice of James Gandolfini.
Do me a favor. Turn around for me.
Okay.
No, go the other way.
Warm, gentle, terrifying persona of actor James Gandolfini.
You got a lot of heart, kid.
Here he is talking about heart in the 1993 movie True Romance, playing the thug, the mob bag man, doing the dirty work for a drug dealer.
Now, the first time you kill somebody, that's the hardest. The second one ain't no honey bar either, but it's better than the first one because you still feel the same thing, you know, except it's more diluted, you know, it's better. Third one is easy, you level right off.
Gandolfini played the low-level mob guy for years.
That's no problem. Now,
showing the human side of sheer brutality.
This is it, baby. Moment of truth. Got a lot of heart, kid, you know that?
A lot of heart, kid. A signature line from a legendary actor, James Gandolfini, died last night suddenly while on vacation. No longer the movie mob underling, he was the boss. Best known as the 21st century godfather of the HBO series, The Sopranos.
Once you enter this family, there's no getting out.
You woke up this morning, got yourself a gun.
The Sopranos changed television. It changed the entertainment industry. And Gandolfini himself changed the character of the Italian-American made guy, a role seemingly set in stone by the famous Godfather movies. Gandolfini single-handedly took it down from the pedestal of some American aristocratic myth and made it American for real.
Let me tell you something. Nowadays, everybody's got to go to shrinks and counselors and go on Sally, Jesse, Raphael and talk about their problems. Whatever happened to Gary Cooper, the strong, silent type? That was an American. He wasn't in touch with his feelings. He just did what he had to do. See, what they didn't know was once they got Gary Cooper in touch with his feelings, that they wouldn't be able to shut him up. And then it's dysfunction this and dysfunction that.
Through Gandolfini, vulnerable, powerful, human, everyone in America could see their place in the dysfunctional family America, in the lottery game of America, where success comes quick and leaves quick.
Why don't you tell me what you're looking for? Maybe I could save you some time.
Any incriminating evidence would be nice.
Dad, they're taking my computer. I have an English paper.
I better have all my programs on there when it comes back.
Anthony.
What the hell are they doing in my kitchen?
You forgot your lunchbox, pal. Why don't you just ask?
The Sopranos was about more than the mob. It was about people saddled with burdens and responsibilities they don't understand but can't escape. For 86 episodes over 6 seasons, when it was over, America had changed. The Sopranos was a television family that a TV show's cancellation could not end. Don't stop believing.
Hold on to that. I wish I could say that it was this emotional experience. I finished, a few of my friends came. I had this large white 69 Cadillac, and we all got in it and drove around and had dinner.
Gandolfini did a lot of driving around and had a lot of dinners. All around the New York metro area, in little restaurants and delis, big restaurants, night spots, next to shots of Sinatra, there are hundreds of photos of James Gandolfini with a signature, generally a personal note, picture with the owner, hug for the owner's wife. Born in New Jersey, James Gandolfini was this city and its many immigrant suburbs. He was an expansive family guy himself. He lived hard, and last night at HBO headquarters, as the news was spreading, he was one of the family, people said. Legendary documentary producer Sheila Nevin said last night, he was the nicest, gentlest bear of a man. I'm devastated. He was a genius, David Chase, the creator of The Sopranos, said last night. Anyone who saw him, even in the smallest of his performances, knows that. He's one of the greatest actors of this or any time. A great deal of that genius resided in those sad eyes. He was my partner. He was my brother in ways I can't explain and never will be able to explain.
James Gandolfini, The Sopranos!
How you doing? I don't know what I'm doing here, but first of all, I'd like to thank the writers of the show.
Humble, generous, only 51 years old, Gandolfini died while on vacation in Rome. The classic story. He made it big in America, made them proud back home in the old country, spreading the wealth around, the love, the life. For all he accomplished, too short.
Focus on the good times. Don't be sarcastic. Isn't that what you said one time? Try and remember the times that were good?
I did?
Yeah.
Well, it's true, I guess.
He portrayed the character, definitely. I mean, he's just, he was big, he was Tony, you know, and that's how I always remember him.
That's restaurant owner Chris Carley remembering what it was like when that final scene you just heard from The Sopranos was filmed in his restaurant, Holston's. Carley says just like so many other places in New Jersey, Holston's has James Gandolfini, Tony Soprano's pictures all over the walls.
Oh, yes, we do. We have quite a few pictures of the shoot along the walls in our dining room, yes.
The last clip we played there was part of that last scene of The Sopranos, which was filmed right there in your restaurant. What was that like? What memories do you have of that scene, of that shoot, and of seeing it then in the last episodes?
It's very good memories. It was a great experience. As far as the final scene, we really didn't know what was going on because they shot it in such fragmented pieces. So when the screen went black, I was just as confused as everybody else was.
But what does it feel like to have been a part of that history, in a sense?
It's very gratifying. I mean, it's I constantly see my place. Different people from all over the country have come and wanted to sit in his booth, and it's just been a very special thing in my life.
And what's the status of that booth today?
Right now, that booth is closed. When I found out that James had passed away, I put a reserve sign on it, and it's been closed since.
What was he like? Did he understand the effect he had on people?
In speaking with him, yeah, I believe he did. He was just an all-around really nice man. He was a professional. I mean, when the cameras were rolling or they were, you know, rehearsing, he was, you know, all business. But when things were shut down and they had a break time, he was a real gentleman outside, you know, smoking a big cigar, talking with the crew, talking with people that were around, taking pictures. He was just a really nice man, very nice man.
What was his favorite thing to order?
He liked hot dogs. he was always grabbing a hot dog.
Well, Chris Carley, thanks so much for joining us.
No problem. Thanks. Have a great day.
Chris Carley is the co-owner of Holsten's, the restaurant where the last scene of The Sopranos was filmed. Speaking to him on the day after we learn of the death of James Gandolfini, the man who played Tony in The Sopranos. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Protests are widening in Brazil, where outrage over a public transit fare hike has become a rolling dissatisfaction with Brazil's government and the Brazilian economy. Those protesters were in Rio this week, but there are now similar protests throughout the country's major cities. Among the objects of anger, expensive construction projects in advance of the 2014 World Cup and 2016 Olympic Games. Joining me now is Eliana Cantanheira, columnist for the newspaper Folha de São Paulo and TV commentator for Global News and Pauta. Welcome.
Hi, John.
You know, looking at all of the pictures in Brazil, it seems as though a bubble has burst in the nation of Brazil that has benefited so much from prosperity over the last decade. What's your view?
Yes, more than the last decade. I think Brazil was going very good since 1983, when the inflation was beaten, you know. But now we are having a lot of problems in economics and in political affairs. And so, as you said, we are having a lot of problems and people are going to say no, and we are tired and we want changes.
This protest began with the price hikes for public transit, but it's a lot more than just bus fares and train fares, yes?
Yes, it started the protests. People went to the streets, and it was funny, John, because nobody expected it. It was a surprise. Nobody understands really what's happening, because we had the idea we were in paradise. Everything was great in Brazil. The world loves Brazil. And then people say, well, we are not in the paradise. We are not in heaven.
Well, the sense that people are angry certainly comes through in the protests, and that they've taken their anger out on preparations for the Olympics and the cost, the $12 billion cost of the Olympics. How much memory do you think these protesters have of the political activism that took place in the 70s and 80s in Brazil that led to the democracy that we have today? Because there's a long history of political protests on a mass scale in Brazil.
Yes. You know, it's funny because we had a huge protest in 1984 when we were ending the dictatorship in Brazil. You remember we had a military regime for 20 years here. We had torture, death. And so people went to the street. It was beautiful because we had the revolution here in peace. And it was a very huge protest, but it was very clear what people wanted. People wanted democracy. And then we had in early 90s, again, a very huge protest here against the president, Fernando Collor. Again, people wanted something very, very clear, the impeachment of President Collor. But now, first of all, the protests here don't have a leader. They don't have parties, and they don't have clear what they want. They want a lot of more, and I think that corruption is a very important word in all of this that's happening here.
Well, we're certainly seeing anger on a mass scale in the population of Brazil, and a series of demonstrations really being driven by social media, as we've seen in many places around the world, without a leader, but with certainly very strong passions and demands for change. Eliana Cantanheda, thanks so much.
Thank you. It was a pleasure to talk to you.
Eliana Cantanheda is a columnist for the newspaper Folha de São Paulo and TV commentator for Globo News in São Paulo.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Is it the beginning of the end? Stocks are selling off after what Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke had hoped would have been a tepid, soft hint that Federal Reserve policy was probably staying the course on its historic stimulus programs. Bernanke's comments, though, have produced lots of jitters in financial markets. John Hilzenrath, chief economics correspondent for The Wall Street Journal, joins us now. Welcome, John.
Hello, John. How are you?
You were at the news conference yesterday, and it seemed to me that as you peppered the Fed chairman with questions, it became pretty clear that he doesn't understand or doesn't have a clear explanation for why interest rates are rising now in a number of places, treasury bills and mortgage rates, that sort of thing.
Well, I mean, I think he sees why it's happening. There's really two reasons, and one reason he would be happy about and the other reason he would be a little concerned about. The first reason is the Fed thinks the economy is getting stronger, and it's actually natural and normal for interest rates to rise when the economy strengthens. So this, and this is something that Bernanke has talked about, this is something that he would welcome, a stronger economy leading to higher interest rates. The other factor, though, which could concern him is, are the markets overreacting to the fact that the Fed might pull back on some of its easy money policies? And is it possible that the markets will overshoot? If the markets overshoot and push interest rates up, you know, instead of a quarter or a half percentage point, a full percentage point, just as for instance, then that actually could choke off the very recovery that the Fed is trying to engineer, and that would be a real problem for them.
It seems, looking at the financial markets, and it's always perilous to try to judge anything based on a couple of days, but the markets don't believe that the economies of the world can go it alone if the Fed and the Bank of Japan stop this quantitative easing, buying treasury assets and buying mortgage-backed securities to prop up the market. True or false?
Well, I mean, I think there's an element of truth to what you're saying, which is why I'm watching stock markets very closely. As I said a moment ago, we should see interest rates rise as the Fed pulls back and as the economy strengthens. The question, though, is how do stock markets react? If the economy really is strengthening, then stock prices should be going up. Well, of course, they have been going up quite a bit for the last year, particularly in the U.S., but now we're seeing them turn lower. If the markets are telling the Fed that if the stock market is telling the Fed it's only been going higher because of Fed stimulus and not because of a stronger economy, well, then the Fed has a problem on its hands. It might have to rethink its strategy.
What's the margin for error here? Do you think markets believe we're too leveraged, there's too much debt in the system, and that we're close to slipping back into the kinds of problems we had in 2008?
No, I mean, I think that was a 2008 problem. I think the 2013 problem continues to be the aftermath of that crisis. Businesses and households and banks, for that matter, remain risk averse. We have a lot of people who are unemployed. People are focused on winding down the debt that they took on, not in the last year or two, but in the 2002 to 2008 period. So there's just a lot of risk aversion, which is holding the economy back. And we also have a federal government, which is and now a fiscal a drag on the economy through tax increases and spending cuts. Those are the problems we're working through. I mean, there have been some signs of froth in some of these markets because of the low rates the Fed engineered, but we're not looking at the kind of massive debt buildups that that we had back then. If anything, you know, the economy is still doing what you would call deleveraging.
John Hilzenrath, chief economics correspondent for the Wall Street Journal. Thanks, John.
Okay.
And we'll leave you with some words from Chairman Ben Bernanke at his news conference yesterday. Good news? The markets don't think so.
Based on its review of recent economic and financial developments, the committee sees the economy continuing to grow at a moderate pace, notwithstanding the strong headwinds created by current federal fiscal policies.
Language story now. Go with me here. If something is killing you, what do you call it? If it's a thug on the street, you call it violence. If it's your own bad choices, a lot of skydiving or helmetless motorcycle riding, helicopter freestyle snowboarding, that sort of thing, then you call it reckless. Diseases kill you as well, and medical conditions are sometimes a complicated mix of behaviors, lifestyles, and the consequences that feed back into your body to create circumstances that doctors have to deal with. Doctors, of course, deal with obesity and the consequences of obesity for individual patients and as a matter of public health for the entire population. Well, this week, the American Medical Association officially recognized obesity as a disease. Is this stating the obvious, or is it playing a language game that insurance companies and health policy experts like to play to simplify a complicated problem? How useful is this designation, obesity as a disease? Dr. Stephen Cook joins us. He's a pediatrician and an associate professor in the Department of Pediatrics at the University of Rochester Medical Center. Welcome, doctor.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Dr. David Liu, also with us, practicing board-certified family physician and author of The Thrifty Patient, Vital Insider Tips for Saving Money and Staying Healthy. Welcome, Dr. Liu.
Thank you for having me.
All right, so Dr. Cook, let's begin with you. Dr. Patrice Harris, who's a member of the AMA's board, says recognizing obesity as a disease will help change the way the medical community tackles this complex issue. How does it change things, Dr. Cook?
I think it's a very important first step because it's going to get us away from the shame and blame game. Obesity as a disease is important because we have to acknowledge the fact that at some point, too much body fat is unhealthy and there are metabolic problems. I'm not saying that every person who has a BMI above a BMI of 30 as a cutoff for obesity has the disease, but it's like blood pressure. You know, everyone has to have some blood pressure. If you don't have any, you're in shock and you're dead. You have to have some body fat. But at some point, having too much body fat is unhealthy. At some point, having too much blood pressure or too high a blood sugar is unhealthy, and that's diabetes or hypertension. And the problem is that without really identifying the disease, then the effective services that should be available to people who have a disease of obesity need to be covered and paid for and made available. I don't want the problem to be overly medicalized, but we do have to acknowledge that there is a disease state.
All right. So designating obesity as a disease is helpful, according to Dr. Stephen Cook. Dr. Davis Liu, what do you think?
Well, certainly I agree with Dr. Cook. Obesity is a problem. I do think, however, it does medicalize a lifestyle issue. Do we want the healthcare system and doctors now to be prescribing more diet pills? Do we want more surgeries for what is arguably a lifestyle issue? It's obvious that it's happening across this country. And the other question would be, are doctors the best trained to counsel patients on lifestyle things, considering that we are not trained very well to do this in medical school? And are there other people who might be better to handle this lifestyle issue?
Is part of the question, though, Dr. Liu, that healthcare is something that's done not just by doctors and that calling it a disease might encourage doctors to actually deal with some of these lifestyle questions better, which would have applications outside of obesity?
Well, let's be honest, right? It's obvious that obesity is a problem. So whether you call it a disease or whether you call it what it is, which is obvious to everybody, I think is not really relevant. I think the question is, do the doctors have the conversations needed to go forward? It's not clear that calling it a disease would actually make that happen. I'd also note the AMA's committee that actually studied this issue for over a year actually had asked and not recommended it be labeled a disease, But the AMA House of Delegates actually overruled them, which I thought was quite interesting. So I think it's controversial. I think we all agree it's a problem. But whether calling a disease going to actually make that country healthier, I think that's the real question. I have some serious skepticism about that.
Dr. Cook, respond to the skepticism, if you would.
The points of this are very valid. It is not clear that calling this a disease really will dramatically change things. But without calling it a disease, if the AMA sits on the fence and doesn't really make a bold statement, that's enough energy for insurance companies, for payers to deny payment of effective treatments. We know that there will be a vast improvement of people if they can lose 10, 15% of their body weight. I'm not saying doctors are the best people to treat it either, but there are effective treatments that are out there. They've been evaluated and reviewed by the U.S. Preventive Services, and those are being endorsed. The problem is, without calling it, without identifying it as a disease, and really using the expertise of people in the field to evaluate this, you're really selling patients short, people who need help. If you look at where healthcare is going, you know, the current system doesn't deal with the acute setting anymore, and our healthcare and interactive system is not appropriate to deal with this. The vast majority of health conditions are related to social and behavioral health issues, whether it's environment, whether it's mental health, lifestyle. I mean, diabetes, hypertension, all these other conditions, depression, heart failure, have huge components of compliance, of behavior, of lifestyle that all play a role into it. So,
all right,
if we can treat a core factor of that being obesity, then I think we have an important first step.
All right, Dr. Cook, Dr. Davis-Liu, respond to this issue that basically calling obesity a disease is a part of a trend that healthcare needs to think of conditions as chronic, not acute.
Well, I mean, Dr. Cook illustrated my point beautifully. It is a chronic condition. Our healthcare system is for acute things. Chronic conditions do not respond to the medical system and doctors and healthcare. And so something real simple fact. If you cut out 100 calories per day, remove a soda can of your diet equivalent per day, you lose 10 pounds a year. Do we need to medicalize that? I think a simple conversation of removing 100 calories per day, the math says you lose 10 pounds a year. So it's incredibly simple to do. I don't think having insurance companies now cover drugs and more surgery is the answer. Do Americans want more surgery and more drugs for a lifestyle change? The answer, I think, is no, probably. And I think this is just schematics more than anything.
Doctors, thanks so much. Doctors Davis-Liu, family physician, author of The Thrifty Patient, Vital Insider Tips for Saving Money and Staying Healthy. And Dr. Stephen Cook, pediatrician and associate professor in the Department of Pediatrics at the University of Rochester Medical Center. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Coming up, students thinking about their summer break. Teachers are getting graded. We're asking you for memories of a teacher who made a difference.
My wife's a sixth grade teacher who changed my life when she agreed to marry me before I left for Iraq. If I could elevate her to sainthood, I would. She's a truly remarkable woman who does not get the appreciation or recognition she deserves because of the fundamental cultural issues that plague public education.
That's Mike from Boston. We got this text from Portland, Oregon. My college professor taught me that brilliance and compassion can coexist. Tell us what makes a great teacher. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. This is The Takeaway. Seasonal story now. At the end of the school year, students get graded. They all do. So do teachers. It can be hard for students and teachers to remember back to what it was like on that fresh first day of school 9 months ago.
So my first day was not at all what I expected. I went in with a carefully planned lesson. I was very nervous, but I had felt after my training that I was a strong classroom manager. And so I felt nervous, but also as confident as a first-year, first-day teacher can be.
There's a teacher, former Teach for America 8th grade language arts teacher in Colorado Springs, Colorado, Matt Barnum. His confidence didn't last.
I remember after the school day was over, going into the bathroom and actually throwing up a couple times. And then I began thinking to myself, how am I going to do this?
A question for all teachers. The school year is a hazing for teachers and students. The mission at the beginning of the year may not be where teacher and student end up at the end. Rarest of all, that teacher who really makes a difference, and not necessarily through book knowledge. My biology photography teacher, Richard Teffen, at Townsend Harris High School, one of our listeners from New York, changed my life by treating me like a person and not just a kid. He was also one of the few bright lights in a very difficult time in my life. And here's another story from San Bruno, California. Mrs. Murdoff, my sixth grade teacher, taught us our basic skills and tied it to real life. Math lessons included keeping a checkbook, and writing included business letters. So does our system of preparing teachers reliably deliver the Mr. Tiffins and the Mrs. Murdoffs? Diane Ravitch is a former U.S. Assistant Secretary of Education, current research professor at New York University, and extraordinarily popular blogger on educational issues, attracting all kinds of attention. Welcome.
Great to be here, John.
Let's talk about the teacher preparedness system. Are we satisfied with the way we're preparing teachers right now and the ratio of those fantastic teachers to the ones that move students along?
Well, you know, the context of the discussion has to be that we're in a time right now where everybody's blaming teachers in a really harsh way. A lot of wonderful teachers, a lot of great teachers that you're talking about are leaving the profession because of this very punitive, toxic atmosphere. If you go to the question of do we prepare teachers well, we prepare a lot of teachers very, very well. Some teachers come in poorly prepared, and they leave pretty quickly. We have the highest dropout rate of any profession is the teaching profession. In the first 5 years, almost half the teachers, between 40 and 50% of the people who start teaching, leave teaching because they are poorly prepared.
So U.S. News and World Report is going to do a ranking system of teacher preparedness programs, and it's based on a study by the National Council on Teacher Quality, and it says that ratings of 1,200 programs at 608 institutions that account for 72% of the graduates of all such programs in the nation performed really, really poorly. Very few programs got 4 stars, most got 2 stars. What do you make of this kind of evaluation of teacher preparedness programs?
Well, I'm a critic of teacher education often. I think that happens to be a particularly ridiculous report. They didn't visit a single institution. They read course catalogs. They looked at reading list. Only less than 10% of the institutions that they evaluated even cooperated them, would not send them syllabuses, would not work with them because the National Council on Teacher Quality is not a professional association. It has no credibility to do the rating that it's done. It's consists of people like Joel Klein, is the former chancellor of New York City, is a member of its board. There are school superintendents who from states like Louisiana, not particularly high-rating states, on its board.
Although Joel Klein does have some credibility.
But he's never been a teacher. I think he spent 6 years as a teacher. He's not a judge of teacher training institutions. In fact, he wasn't even part of the evaluation. The evaluation was done strictly by reviewing course catalogs and syllabi, and that's a ridiculous way. That's like saying we're going to review all the restaurants in New York City, but we'll never visit them. We'll just look at the menus. You cannot review a restaurant without tasting the food.
You have argued that teacher training programs are light on the amount of classroom experience that teachers need before they start that first day. What would you recommend there?
Well, I think the example of the one that's lightest on classroom experience is Teach for America. The young man that you just cited, Matt Barnum, had 5 weeks of training before he became a teacher. I understand why he threw up after his first day of teaching. He didn't know what was about to hit him. Teach for America is the prime example of ill-prepared teachers, and they don't go through teacher training institutions at all. The same thing, there are other kinds of programs, like there are a lot of online programs, which I think is a ridiculous way to prepare teachers. Teachers need to have a year of good, solid teacher education, teacher preparation, where they not only learn about what they're going to teach. I mean, it's one thing to be a master, to have a master's degree in English, to have a bachelor's degree in English, but then you have to learn how to teach kids. You have to learn how to control a classroom. You have to have the pedagogical skills, and you have to learn something about the politics and the history of education so you're not reinventing the wheel. But the most important thing you need is that ability to communicate with students. You can have it all in your head, and I can tell you I know lots of brilliant young people who've gone into the classroom, and they had all the degrees in the world, and the kids, they just couldn't control the kids. So that practical experience, practice teaching, is absolutely crucial.
Would you say, I mean, there is, you know, everyone has a story of a teacher who was really meaningful to them, and it wasn't necessarily the teacher or the subject that they would have expected. It's typically someone with a lot of experience, not someone who came straight out of teacher training. Are we to be satisfied with that situation? Do we pass best practices of the experienced teachers along to the young teachers effectively enough to maybe make that more of a general experience rather than the rare experience?
Well, when you talk to teachers, they will say that the most important training they had was what happened when they came into the classroom and then an older teacher was assigned to help them. In many cases, was not assigned to help them, but they sought out the help of the more experienced. That's why one of the great tragedies today in American education is so many senior teachers are leaving because they feel the disrespect of our society, the disrespect of our media, movies like Waiting for Superman that demonize teachers.
Part of this is the tenure program getting so much criticism, yeah. It bears a lot of criticism on the most experienced teachers.
Well, exactly, because when you remove tenure, you also remove academic freedom. And there are state after state, particularly the red states, that have eliminated tenure. They have denied teachers any credits for experience. Or that they won't pay them extra for extra years or for degrees. So they're basically saying you don't need to have a master's degree in your subject. You don't need to have extra years of experience. What they're really saying is they want to have young people coming and going and lower the cost of teaching. This is what's happening all over the country, and it's late to reach New York because of the strong union here. Most states don't have strong unions, and by now, almost half the states are right-to-work states where the unions are very weak indeed. So teachers are in flight. And the statistic I wanted to mention is that if you look back 20 years ago, most teachers had an average of about 15 years experience. Today, today, the modal year of experience is 1 year.
Diane Ravitz is former U.S. Assistant Secretary of Education and a research professor at New York University. How many page views of your blog?
In the next day or two, it's going to hit 5 million.
All right. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, John.
At the end of the school year, you're sending us memories of outstanding teachers. Here's one from L.A. Mrs. Wakely, my fourth grade teacher, made reading fun and made all the difference. We always want to hear from you. Tell us who made the difference for you at 877-8-MY-TAKE or tweet us at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.